Good, so welcome again.
Any very, 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 very important question from your side? Sleepless nights, hunted by a thought.
Okay.
That's really disappointing. Nobody, nobody is saying something. Okay, so this on the other side is very positive in the way that we can go on further on with our readings and with our texts. So as we said last time, I wanted to go through already, but it did not work. So we were now in Vedanta. We said 1,000 years chanting from the beginning to the end of the Vedas, and we had just this one text last meeting to remember. So on one side it was said the heart is the place where all the sensory perception do gather. So it's the gathering, the collection of very much like the German word Gemüt, which is probably better than heart. It's another word in German for the heart, but it has another aspect that is strong in Gemüt. It's really the gathering of all sensual experiences in ourselves, that means in consciousness. And the second thing, this was then the long discussion last week that we were speaking about this. That in their perception, when we are in deep sleep, you're in deep sleep, and of course we will see later this has a lot to do then also how they see death, because in a certain way deep sleep is always the brother of or sister of death, and so this then also has to do a lot with how they understand dying in a certain way, so that they are literally saying that in deep sleep you are in the emptiness of your heart. So this is something that in deep sleep you are in. This is the place of your heart in the way that you are yomen. It's you can translate it either to emptiness or to ether. Yeah? Which for me is always the same, but not. This would be a long discussion also. What ether is, the quintessence, the fifth element. So to fire, earth, water, air, you have a fifth element, which is ether. And it is the gathering also of all the four former elements, yeah, in Indian philosophy. So if you have fire, air, water, and earth, you bring them, their gathering is in a space that is called ether, or it's all mostly translated in Europe as it's a space in which all the four elements do reside in a certain way or come together, or we would even say they are vibrating in the ether. So this is a vibrating space where earth, but of course here, this is very important in my reading. Also here, the ancient cultures were not so stupid as we often see. So for example, probably you heard that in school that they thought that the Erde ist eine Scheibe. So they were quite primitive because they thought the Earth is a kind of Scheibe. How should we?
Oh, it's flat.
Yeah, flat. Yeah. But in my reading, they thought the Earth's plane is flat. Not the Earth is flat, because in ether, even in Timaeus and Plato, in this, the script for nature philosophy, we have the physics of Aristotle and we have Timaeus. For 2,000 years, this was doing physics, means reading Timaeus and reading Aristotle's physics. So even there in Plato, you still have, as I said, Plato is always very interesting for me in intercultural philosophy, because I share, I said it already, the opinion that Plato was in Europe The last one was close in touch with very ancient concepts of old cultures. And therefore, Plato for us in a certain way is a way of also a translation machine, as my mentor Vital would say. Yeah, so he helps us to translate these archaic cultures for us into a culture and language that is closer to our European or continental or Western culture, which we have in a certain way. Yeah? So Ether is quite complicated because Plato says that he has four elements, yeah, and Ether is not clear. He says only that Ether is, in Timaeus he says, Ether is the most sublime element. So it's the most sublime air, he even says. Yeah? It's air where it almost becomes like space. It's so sublime air. So it's the softest or the most sublime element of all the four elements. And I interpret elements to be waving bodies. Yeah? So I cannot go in this. But I would say in ancient cultures, element is called a waving body, what they would call an ocean. Yeah? As I said, so what my wipes, which I send, they are etheric. Yeah? So the sound which I express now is an elemental body because it's etheric. Yeah? It's ether. Yeah? It's waving space. Yeah? So that would be just the one thing. So because here it is called during deep sleep, we are in the emptiness of the heart. It's usually translated emptiness, but it is literally ether, the owner. It's not shunyata. Emptiness in this context, but they have quite a lot of names for something like emptiness, empty space. One is shunyata, which is strongly in the Buddhist context, yeah, and in East Asia. And then you have yomen, which is closer to what we call ether, yeah. And then you have akasha, which is close to space. Akasha is usually really space. But they all, of course, go into the same direction. So this is what we had in the last meeting. So it's that place in the heart at the same time of sleep. So we are naked by night. We have in this way an experience. This is also very important for me if you think of phenomenology. So it's not just an experience. In the experience of deep sleep, we have in a certain way a non-experience of this, as an experience in which you lose consciousness, in this way a non-experience, but it's an experience. So in phenomenology, it's not just a seal. Yeah, as Husserl would say, it's not just Urteil judgment, but it is experience. Experience is more than just being a theory or a judgment. It's something which you bodily experience night by night. But this is where I would call it. It's also not just a theory, but to say you can experience what I'm saying up, either if you are European, Austrian, or Greek, you can experience it because in deep sleep you are literally making this experience in a bodily manner. Yeah. So that was the first thing. Then also we have a passage which I. Of course, I made the remark that if we put it back to our diagram, and this was also mentioned by one of you in the last meeting, that in a certain way, in the diagram which I showed, it would be the lower ocean. So if you go back 1,000 years earlier to the beginning of the Veda, they would have called it. So during night, you are going back into the lower ocean. Yeah? There where we have this. Then there are different, maybe we have 1,400 something, whatever we call it, root matter. Of course, you have a history also of these terms. But these would be terms who are going in this direction. And then we have the heart is both, it is said, an organ and a function, or if you prefer, a place. the secret cave, and an activity, that of intuition. Okay, this is the passage from Will Ortega, page 79, quoted in French. So, original French. So what is now said in another passage here also, we are still in an early Upanishad, so we are about 600, 700 before our time. Yeah? So that's approximately the date. And there the heart is said, so again, this is why I said, because we immediately think when we speak of the heart, we speak of an organ. And here it is said, the heart is not so much an organ as we are used to understand it, but more a function, if you prefer, a place. And now the secret cave. This is quite interesting, because this is a concept that is coming again over thousands, you really have thousands of years. That is the theory that in your heart there is a cave. Yeah? So, and where, it's not on the top, it's not in the middle, but again at the very bottom. At the very bottom of your heart there is the ocean of the lower ocean of the subconscious, as we have read it or interpreted. And in this deep sea, yeah, when you go into the deep sea of your subconscious, yeah, at the very bottom of this ocean, there is a secret cave. Yeah. There is a secret cave. I said again, they told that about themselves, they are spiritual poets, cards. So they use a language of images, of course. Yeah, so with these images they wanted to, they thought that in images you can tell best these things. So if you go down into the depths, in the background of your heart, you come to the lower ocean, you're going into the depths, and then you go very down into that ocean, there is a kind of treasure cave. And this is very important since the beginning of the Veda times, because it is in the real estate, this secret heart cave, this is hiding something. So at the very bottom of your subconscious, there is almost like a hidden treasure, yeah, that was hidden. And you, in a certain way, if you go very down into deepest depths of your subconscious, you will find a treasure and you have to free it. Yeah? They all even say it has been stolen to yourself. Yeah? So it has been stolen and hidden. So it's really, what is another word for cave? It's a crypt. Yeah? So it's really, a crypt is very important, because this does not mean, oh, our mind is not possible to understand. But what they suggest is there is something critical in our human being. So as Heraclitus again says, there is something, when you come to this world, it's not that, oh, everything is obvious. But you are hidden to yourself. So there is something hiding you. So to understand who you are, gnoti heokon, Socrates, to understand who you are means you can only pose this question, because as Heidegger would say, there is alethe, there is lethe, there is something hiding yourself in front of yourself. You are hidden for yourself. And this means there is something verborgen, or as the Greek really would say, and I think this is very close to what they would say, the secret heart, there is something critical in you. So being born as a human being means that you are not self-transparent. You are not born as a kind of being that has a very clear concept about itself. But why don't you have it? Because there is something withdrawing, to take a Heideggerian term again, in yourself there is something that withdraws, that has stolen the knowledge about yourself in yourself. Yeah? And that is this mystic, cryptic cave in the heart. And in the Rigveda, in the beginning of the Veda, this was very central because it was all about opening that cryptic. And cryptic, of course, has a lot to do with the dead body, with the corpse. Yeah. So in Catholic context, if you have a crypta, this is the dead bones of holy people, yeah, which you have probably in the cell region, again in the subconscious, yeah, like Hitchcock, yeah, you go in the cell, yeah, region, and there you find such critical things like corpse, yeah, death bodies, and this kind of thing. So this is also a lot which there's a lot of fear around that cave. But you need courage, you need, as the German word Gemüt says, Mut, in order to open yourself to do this deep search into this heart cave. And if you can open that cave, that crypta, what is coming out of the crypta, if you succeed? So they often say it's like your brain has to send a ray into that subconscious crypta, so that this felsen, yeah, this stone which hides the crypta, is distinguished. Yeah? It's like your schwert. Yeah? So you have this in many science fiction in a certain way. Yeah? And many you have this sword and it in a certain way splits the stone. And what is coming out, if you are able to do this, is the honeyed wave of God. You release the honey wave. So if you are in the very top of this secret heart cave, at the bottom of your subconscious, and you succeed to open that cave, then in a certain way, the whole honeyed wave is coming out. Yeah? A wave of bliss is coming from the depths of your ocean. And it's so, in a certain way, it's that what you now have released, yeah, in a certain way, from the very bottom of your heart. So this is the so-called cryptical or secret, or what are translations? Sometimes even they call it the mystical, because that's really silence, because there's a lot of angst, of fear around this case. In the subconscious, it's almost traumatic. But if you succeed and can open it, then in a certain way, what is coming out is something highly pressured. And so there are two words. So on one side, it's very often described as being, if you can open that, you can, a wave of bliss is coming out. Yeah, a honey wave of ananda that is coming out of the secret heart cave at the very bottom, as the treasure in your subconscious. And when you release it, it now vertically does arise in you. So it's something like a wave that comes up, yeah, out of these depths and arises in you. So this is the secret, a place, the secret heart cave, and an activity of intuition. And that's also, so it's not just that if you can open that cave, that crypta, in the very, on the very depths of your heart ocean, then in a certain way, not only the blissful, delightful wave of ananda, yeah, of bliss is coming out, but also it triggers what, which we had strongly in Gonda, as the most important function of the heart in the beginning of the Vedas. What it does not just trigger in your heart a blissful feeling, but it does also trigger in yourself an activity. Which kind of activity? That of intuition or wisdom. And this is what Gonda says, this is the most frequently used function of the heart in the beginning of the day. that in certain way, if you free that, you get a vision. Yeah? So the effect that it triggers is that you suddenly have a kind of intuitive vision. And of course, what the vision then would be, it would be the vision of truth. So that is, it triggers not just a blissful wave in your heart, but it also triggers a kind of truth consciousness, right? As many would say. So you suddenly have an intuitive understanding of truth, yeah? Which is triggered through that. And this really comes from the very depths of your unconscious. Right? What we find here again as a way of how the heart is understood at these times. Some more texts of this period, Chandogya Upanishad. There is one thing that I was asked last time, what the Upanishad means, and I said, so I'm not correcting myself, I was absolutely right what I said, the word Upanishad means that I am sitting next to your feet. But again, in the one text which I gave you also on a PDF on Moodle, is the text, this is the only text from a kind of Swami. Yeah, Aurobindo, in a certain way you could also say he was a yogi. So he would claim that he was, because Skora or Müller-Ortoga or Duskovsky, they are scholars. Yeah? So they would not claim that they are yogis. But Aurobindo, of course, would call that he is not just a scholar, he's a yogi. And this guy also. So I usually rarely use these kind of texts. But since I gave you this text or uploaded it, it is what he, for example, and that's even a so-called guru, because we had this thing of what does it mean to kiss the feet of Upanishad, means literally sitting near the feet of your master. And I just quote here from this page 35, from this PDF which I gave you. He must work to develop great velocity of awareness, also a yogi, let's say, until he reaches the feet of the master. So literally the Upanishad. By this I do not mean, says even a very orthodox Swami, by this I do not mean the master's physical feet. Being at the feet of the master means reaching that state where the aspirant is capable of receiving the grace of the master. So again, of course, literally they do it. In very orthodox circles you see it. And what astonished me that I saw a lot of Western, especially young women, who are doing this, because I have never have done this. Also my teacher would never have allowed to do this at all. And this does mean, when we go back to the diagram, where do we sit now as he interprets this close to the feet? If you see the upper ocean as a feet, in a certain way that feeds you, then in a certain way it would be the surrender to the upper ocean, yeah, for them. So you see, this is very tricky, yeah, on which levels. We have this on many levels, which is politically really a problem, Aurobindo would say, because we have this especially in the impression of the ocean and the seven rays. So I told you very shortly already that the main Sindhu River is going right now politically through, so the geographical river that is usually identified with the most important of the rivers in the Veda is going through Pakistan. And this is really a political issue for these people who interpret this literally as Sindhu, does mean this river that is going to Pakistan, which of course is a political issue for people who believe this. Yeah? And Aurobindo is strongly against this, saying these are psychological truths. We should not think of Sindhu of being a physical water that is going right now politically through Pakistan, which can create a war for these people, yeah? So that's very political in India. But Aurobindo says, no, please not. These are also, okay, you can really kiss physically the feet of your master, as it happens in there are ashrams and training centers in India, but this is only a proper thing if you don't mix up that you are not right now kissing the feet, literally, of your master, but that you surrender to the higher ocean. And the same is true for Aurobindo with the rivers. He again and again says these are psychological functions and not physical rivers. Yeah? But for us, we read this, and we, if you read The Secret of the Veda, which I have uploaded, you probably say, okay, this seems to be quite evident. But right now, in the Hindu milieu, this is really a political issue. This is really something of who owns this land. So these are not just scholarly interpretations, but they can become very real for the people, how you interpret these kind of things. Okay, so we are still, we were in the Chandogya Upanishad. So we are still in the context of the Upanishad. I quote one more. Verily, what the body in man is, that is the same as the heart within man here is. Or, this is the one which I had already, because I skipped one. So, genau. So this is the next. So we go here on. This is still an early Upanishad. The teacher, Yajnavalkya, then identifies the person. This is also very dangerous translation, Purusha, person, in the heart. Indra, by name, is this person here in the right eye. Yeah? And I just show you that you can rarely understand anything from the Western context of this thing if you don't know the background tradition. It makes simply no sense what is saying here. So I take this as an example, but how it starts probably here to make a little bit sense is when you know the context of this. So the cultural context of this text. This is why I've chosen this, and this is probably a picture which you could find in many yoga centers today. The teacher, Yajnavalkya, then identifies the person, the Purusha, in the heart. Indra, by name, is his person here in the right eye. So here, literally, this is a typical image of the chakra, of how they understand the body, for the yogic body, yeah, in Indian culture, which is from the practical book, Religiousness and Yoga, from Desikachar. Just a picture from there. And of course, he says now Indra is the right eye. Yeah? So you really have to make it literal. Yeah? So my right eye. So something here. This is where one part of my person lives. Yeah? Here in the right eye. Now, that which has the form of a person in the left eye is the wife of it. Viraj. Viraj is very difficult. You know, I really would have to speak now hours and hours about Indra and Viraj. I cannot do this. So just, it's something else which I want to show. Yeah? Viraj is in a certain way the wife of Indra, and it is also one of his symbols. Yeah? And Viraj in a certain way is purified blood, you can say. Yeah. So Viraj has a lot to do with the female, because it has a lot to do with menstruation and all these things. So it has to do with menstruation, female menstruation, circle and all that. I cannot go into these details. But in a certain way, they say here, so it's really, it has to do a lot with blood and heart. Their meeting place, and now what is interesting for me? Their meeting place, so we have the right eye and we have the left eye. Now where Indra and Neeraj, in a certain way, a male and a female principle is dwelling and living, their meeting place is the space within the heart. Yeah? Now, where is the meeting place between the two eyes in this image, which is very typical? So you can find this through centuries and centuries. So where would you say, where is now the place between the right and the left eye? So what would you say? So which, what would you say is the meeting place between the right and the left eye?
Well, technically further, the space between the left and the right.
Okay, they have a long tradition of thinking that the right and the left eye have here a barrier, yeah, where they are connected, yeah, where they come together. And what they do then is making here what?
Third eye.
Yes, the third eye. And how do women, for example, what do they do in here? They have bindu, which is really one of the most common signs of, if you want to know whether somebody is coming from India and is a Hindu, is the point, yeah? And also if you go to a temple, also men will get this point here, yeah? So it's usually their theory, this is a kind of coming together of our left. And you know, we have something like, we say, oh, this is really crazy. But right now, if we have neuroscience, we have all these things, how do the right half of the brain come together with the left half of the brain? So we have this kind of theories in modern neuroscience strongly, and even very popular. Many people will tell you on the road, even this is almost a common sense today, that they will say, oh, you are a person who has a strong left side of your brain, and the other. So in a certain way here, the heart is, as we saw it in so many contexts, it's really the queer organ. I mean this seriously, not just fashionable. Yeah? It's the queering organ because it brings together dualities. It has the capacity to yoke duality, where the mind is thinking in dualities. So the left is not the right and the right is not the left. The heart is a kind of yoking and bridging of this duality principle by crossing them. Yeah? Or like Merleau-Ponty does say, it's chiastic and chiasmus. So the heart is never the one or the other, it's the organ of mediation between two points. And so you have one point here, you have one point here, and in the middle you have the bindu, yeah, which means point. You have the bindu or anu. Yeah. You have the bindu or the anu, which in a certain way does not just is this point as a third point, but it is the middle that mediates between the duality principles. Yeah. So it's that what in many practices and techniques is called the technique of centering. Yeah? So you try to center, means in the context of yogic techniques and practice, that you have two points and you want to find the middle point between them. Yeah? And this is one of the most important functions of what they would call the heart. So what in you does find the mediation between two points? It's the heart. And this is true for every principle of duality. Here the duality principle is called Ida and Bengali, But in other traditions, it's called Ha and Ta. Always it's called Sun and Moon. Yeah? Ida Pingala Sun Moon. So it brings together Sun and Moon, mediates them, and this is why it creates the center of duality. Yeah? So if you have two eyes, then must the heart be involved. Because the heart is for them the function that mediates and creates a middle point between two points. Yeah? And this is why the heart is connected with the concept of center and middle. So in a Hegelian terminology, what mediates between oppositions is by definition what they would call the heart. The heart in a certain way is the dialectical organ for them. Yeah? Because the mind does separate. He is analytical. He separates, he will always see two points. But the heart serves the middle that is centering, crossing, bridging, yoking, and mediating between two points. This is even, I come to you, this is even true when we are standing here. When you sit there and I sit there, the mind will say, you are there and I am here. But the heart will say, I have to come into the middle of us two. And only if I am in between of us two, I have a heart full. I have a heart full relation to you. As long as we are not in the middle, which between us now would be somewhere there, then we are mindful, but not having a relation that is a cordial relation. Yeah? So that is true for all principle of two points. And in Sanskrit it's very important because the most important letter in Sanskrit, we have it already, it's the letter Rish. Visharga. It's the breath. It's the sound of the breath. This is the last letter. And it's the sound of the breath. It's so when you have Om, you are saying, so the most important thing is the fourth, and the fourth is the, it goes back to silence. It goes back to silence. So that is always the thing. Yeah? This is why in real yoga, if you have a good yoga, if you have a good yoga center, then of course they will always go to this vishara. Yeah, so that this is not just what they would say, it's at the end of every letter and pronunciation. It's not just that I always breathe here and producing the breathing always as a sound, this yeah, that's the basic sound. And then there comes the other letters on this sound. But the basic sound is always the breath. And even I do this not just when I do closing the mouth and then, but I do this at the beginning of the, always I did this the whole time. So before I started, I do this sound of, I tell you, I always take this breath. So that breath sound, Visarga, is always going through the whole lines of sequence of articulation for them. It's base tuning, and it is written, and I'm coming to you, it is written, how does Sanskrit write this letter? How is it written in Sanskrit? Two points. Yeah? So what mediates you and me is in a certain way the point in the middle between these two points. Yeah? And it is the breath that mediates between us two. So between you and me, there is a breathing circle in which you and me are points, but they are mediated in the breath. Yeah? This is so important, as you would say, when you have a chorus, you have to have the same breath. Yeah? You become notes of one breath, more. And this is the living principle and the soul and the heart. So,
did you say the eyes were queer, or the eyes were themselves brought together the dualities, or was it the heart that brought them together?
Exactly, they would say wherever you have two points, which is the Visharga, which is the breath of the. Which, by the way, of course, is very important for sexuality. Yeah. Why do we have in sexuality this strong yeah? So that would be the tantric thing. So that is quite an international language or sound which is done. So the heart is the bridging of duality. So it creates a middle point between two points. And therefore it is called the technique of centering. The technique of centering means that I do not see the opposition of two points, but I go into the middle of two points and start to see them from the middle. And what is bringing you into the center of the middle point, that's your question, is the heart in the circle. In most, almost all techniques. If you come to Kashmir Shaivism, and we will see the techniques and the techniques of Vijnana, Bhairavya, it's all about center. So you have two things, two points, and you try to go into the center in order to see the middle of these two points. And that is the performance of your heart. Yeah? And in the eyes, it's not just, they would say, what brings duality here together is the middle, and this in a certain way where your heart resides when both eyes are in their center. They reside in a certain way in the heart space. Yeah? Is this an answer or not?
Yes, it is. No, I thought maybe that the eyes themselves were special and that they got together, but then the heart was the bridge.
Of course, it's you cannot separate them so easily. Of course, it's if you don't have the two points, there is nothing to need. Yeah? So it's really wherever, but for them, it's very general. This is only one example. Yeah? But it does not make any sense. Yeah, if you don't know the context, what does it mean? Interesting. And Viraj in the other. But if you start to know the context of the back culture and back, this is what I want to show. It suddenly starts, at least one can, this is how they thought. I don't say that we agree, but I just want to show at this example that these things which seems to have no sense, as in for us usually when we read it, suddenly from their context start to make sense. So the Bindu is, again, also because we said, where is the heart, you were as an organ. So in a certain way, this Bindu is one place of your heart because it combines the duality of your eyes, which again is connected with vision. Yeah? So it's the center that mediates between duality and gives you a singular vision in a certain way of the both eyes. Yeah? And therefore it is that is a synesthetical experience in a certain way by bringing together these two perspectives into one. And this is why this so-called third eye or the Bindu is so important. One, two, was there another?
Yeah. Just wanted to ask today's date something about the nose as well, because the thought is that this connection could be the nose as well, or if we think about picture theory or seeing and vision, like the Western scientists like know now that somehow that the nose is actually like very important for our like way of seeing and for realizing distances. And so, yeah. I'm wondering if they're saying something about the nose, or why shouldn't it be the nose?
Yeah, there is even a box on Mars. There is even a very important coordinator, which is called the dog. Yeah, it's literally the god of dogs, because they have this extraordinary nose. Yeah? So they have this extraordinary smell, yeah, like most animals have. Much better, more sensitive nose than we humans have, yeah, in a certain way. So there is a God, it has to do with this. But this would bring us now very close in the physiognomy of Indian philosophy. And of course, they also have, like we had in ancient times, the theory of the five senses, the five sense organs, indriyas, but they would distinguish between the five sense organs and the five cognitive sense organs. I cannot go into this in too depth now, because it's all along. But also here, for example, in this book, which I uploaded you here, this is a quite very... this is not very sophisticated, this is a swam. Yeah, but he gives you all these kind of clear sorting criteria. Yeah? And there you have the motor sensual, so they have something like kinesis, the five sense organs, which creates mobility, yeah, in us. And then they have the five sense organs, which create cognition. But that's a whole, I cannot go into this text. But in this text, for example, if you look quite at the beginning, you have the 36 tattvas, the 36 principles of the cosmos, and there you have first the five, you have 25 tattvas first, and there you have five elements. These are the five which I mentioned already, earth, water, air, fire and ether, and then you have already the five sense organs, and there would be smell, taste, and all these kind of things. And then it goes to cognitive, indriyas, and then so you have 25 at the end. Principles which end with prakriti and purusha. And then the tantric have in Samkhya Yoga, so in the classical tradition of yoga philosophy, you have these 25 principles, and then the tantric said this is all true, but there exists 11 more. So they have 36. So they say they know, they would say the yoga, Samkhya Yoga, does only know 25 principles. So it was for them, it was the thing that there are 11. So they are on the basis of this 25 and then go on for 11 more. But this would be really all the whole semester. I cannot go into depth in this.
I was trying to fit this breathing process in German terms, and we have the word Austausch, mm-hmm. and that includes an economical thinking, mm-hmm. for exchange. That's maybe interesting in this sexual context too, mm-hmm. but this breathing is vegetative too. It goes effortless, it is always in the background, it goes without thinking about a profit. I don't think in this future about an exchange, what can I gain for breathing? I gain nothing from breathing, I always breathing. Mm-hmm. And that's true in interpersonal relationships too. But what is a heard also in this text, maybe in exchange relationship with others?
That's a very good point again. Yeah, and they still had the economy of grace. Yeah, this is something very strange, because we have lost this totally, because grace means literally dana, it's an economy of the giving. Yeah, and we have totally lost this. For us, grace is a religious term, but even in Latin, grace does not mean just grace of a god, but it in aesthetical terms means beauty, anmut, and it means grazie, thank you. Yeah? So these are still economies of grace, and this means these are economies of giving. Yeah? And Derrida, for example, yeah, one of my readers, he has written a philosophy of the garbe. Marion has written a phenomenology, it's very important. He has written the logic of the gift, the economy of the gift, yeah, of the giving, yeah, which of course should have been a critique of neoliberal economy of profit. Yeah. And so quite a lot of critical thinker from the left, yeah, have tried to create an economy of giving as a critique of the economy of neoliberal profits. Yeah. And of course their ways are very important. Why should we not give pay for any breath? This would be good. So for breathing you are paid. This would give a totally different system of income, yeah? Because everybody has to breathe. So you would have a kind of salary for just doing what you are always doing, and so to say, giving a value to these things which you are doing automatically. Yeah. And not the things which you have to strongly fight for. Yeah. I have to fight for that I will gain more profit. Work hard and you will make. Yeah. This creates tension in your breath, yeah, in your breathing system in a certain way. And so it would be absurd if we would say we are paid because also we get a ground salary for doing the work of breathing. Yeah? So why are these models not even discussed or simply curious in our, as absurd in our thing? But why is breathing not valued in our society? Why are you not paid? Because we are no more in the economy of giving. Yeah, that this is something good, as you said, between in many indigenous cultures you would have the trees are giving something. They give something to us. But then we have modern economy with the Fichte or so, where you say they are material. They are material. This is something matter becomes material. Yeah, there is a big change if you call matter. Listen, Fichte sagt, Materie ist, usually I know by heart, but something going in saying, we is here in order to be used from us. Yeah? But this is a misuse of an anthropological misuse of the way they themselves give something to us. Before we use them. Yeah? I think now economies simply starting to realize that in a certain way a tree gives us something not only if I make wood out of it, but as a tree. Yeah? And we now, even the European Union now is trying to renaturalize big parts of Europe. Because in a certain way, they give something that is not just a surplus value for humans. Yeah? And all this goes, of course, in this direction. So dana, then the whole pitta, yeah, pada. Yeah, these are all words who are going into this economy of giving and receiving, of course, of austausch. So it's the economy of the gift, as Derrida would say. So can we think again an economy of the gift, yeah, as an alternative of what we have right now? But this is a very strong topic in late Derrida, and it is, of course, Marion in phenomenology. You find a lot of people who suddenly said, you know, it's all about this gift and giving economy, which is a different economy than the circus economy. And their values are somewhere else, yeah? And not just in this. Because exchange value in Marx is exactly the difficulty. Therefore, I hesitate a little bit with austausch, because of course austausch is close to hunger. Yeah? And so you have world economy, world handel. So you are coming, you have to distinguish here between which kind of austausch this is, yeah, that we affirm.
You don't need to elaborate more, but Bataille has also an economy theory of Verschwendung. I am not sure the English term would. This Verschwendung is also a giving without thinking about gain.
Of course, this is the logic of generosity. So how can we give? We have an economy of money. Yeah? So there is always not enough money for all. There is always not enough for all. Yeah? Generosity is the consequence. There is too much from it. Nature is producing too much. So we cannot even eat everything. So that would be the logic of generosity. Yeah? There is much too much and not too less. But if there is too less, we come to the fighting discourses of who gets what. Here. So this goes in this direction. So it is said here that between the eyes there is the meeting place, is the space within the heart. And now they say the path that they go, also the eye and the right eye and the left eye and their meeting place, the path that they go is that channel, that nadi, which goes upward from the heart. Like a hair divided a thousandfold, so are the channels called hitta, which are established within the heart, which is the soul? Fragezeichen. So what would you say is this now? So when I go to the diagram, so we had the heart, we had the other, and we had this circle in the middle, which in a certain way would be the bindu. And now what it is saying that the heart is not just this circle that bridges the two eyes, because they now say the path that they go is that channel which goes upward from the heart. So this was my interpretation, Sushumna. This is a very important term in Indian philosophy, so you find it really also through the centuries, thousands of years. And this is so, Sushumna is usually, this would be this line. Yeah? And their theory is in a certain way that this is a non-dimensional stream, a thread. Yeah? This is a thread that has not yet an expansion. Therefore, they would say you cannot find it because it has not a spatial dimension. It is a thread in a certain way that goes through the middle of your body. Yeah? So there is this middle axis, and around there is a kind of helix. Yeah? There is a kind of helix, yeah, a snake, that in a certain way goes in spirals around this middle axis of the Sushumna, and since it is a helix, it has two ends. One is called Ida and the other is called Pingali, or some of you know Hatha Yoga, it is Ha and Ta. in several traditions. Of course, the name sounds like it's over. We are speaking about 4,000 years. So, of course, in different ages, different names also for this kind of description. But this is quite going, running through quite all of the, or most of the ages in philosophy, such a picture. So in a certain way, you have this middle axis, and this middle axis would be a white, which means it is the same, the non-dual center. But usually, people have not a non-dual sushumna, but if one would look here, they would say, if I could see your subtle body, we are here, probably all would not have just a one thread, but they would have a helix around this. Yeah? Because they would say, as long as you are in a perception of duality, you have two strings. Yeah? So they are not united in the middle thing of the center of the sushumna. They would only unite if you start to have a non-dual perception of the body. Then in a certain way you would be in the center. You would be in the sushumna and the duality principle. So, and this sushumna would always be the middle of yourself and the middle of your heart. The middle always means the heart. Yeah? So if that is in the middle, then you are in the middle of yourself. You are in your center. Yeah? So that is the thing. And around this center there is this kind of helix way of steps, yeah, which are around this middle thread going up. Yeah? This is usually. So if you have here, you are in the duality principle. Yeah? That goes like a helix, it goes here up. And at a certain way, in this, so if you are here or in this middle, they would say it, you are in your heart. You are in the center of yourself. If you go up here, you are still in the heart, but you are experience the heart from a duality center. And this bindu, again, in the middle of your heart, is a very important space of your heart, because what happened in this diagram here, in the third eye, according to them, what changed to from this sixth chakra to the seventh chakra? What is different?
There is no helix anymore.
Exactly. So then, you are in a non-dual state. So if you have openness, they would say, your third eye, then in a certain way you have reached a center in which all the duality principles do in a certain way come together, and what is above you is non-dual. So you are now in a space, in a certain way, in which you can, if you go up from this heart point, so the heart point is not just, this is an important point, of course, this is the heart, because what would you say, why is this especially called the center, the heart center? Why is that what we in Europe would more call the heart? Is also in India called in a certain way the heart. What would you say of what we have said so far? Because where is it within?
Because it's right in the middle.
Yes. So it's again a middle part. Yeah? So if you have the whole duality principle that resides in the middle. So this is quite complex. This is not so simple as you have most yoga students. So this point again is the middle point of the upper and lower, the bindu, in which the duality principle stops. And the anu, which is the shakti point at your anus. The word anus is Sanskrit, because anu means point in Sanskrit. So if we have the German word anus, it's a Sanskrit word, because we are coming from the same Sanskrit. Family. Yeah? So anus here, in a certain way, is really Sanskrit and means also like Hindu point. So you have the Bindu point and you have the Anu point, which is the lowest point in the lower ocean of yourself. So there is Anu, which by the way is the female point. Yeah. It's usually a trick would be the Shakti point. Yeah. So this is only female, this whole region, yeah, in the Earth loss.
Why does it stop at the hip and is not going to the legs as well?
Yeah, because the stick, as they would say, the stick, the spine does anything. So this is also why the sitting posture is so important for them, because you bring the end of your spine to the earth. Yeah? When I stand, the legs are in a certain way, as you say, in between. Yeah? I don't have the circle. If I sit, I have suddenly the arm at the earth, yeah, on the earth. So I get in contact in a certain way with the earth. So the bottom down is now close to the earth, which I also said is the lower ocean, because that in a certain way is the principle, the Scheibe, earth as a sheet, and not earth as a body like the planet Earth. This is why I said they were, in my opinion, they were not so stupid that they just saw that the earth is a sheet or something, that, but they meant something different. They meant a plane. And as a plane, the earth, of course, for them in their system is a sheet. Like all the other sheets are sheets. They are more oceans and sheets than being a body, a solid body. And that's, of course, because if I speak of the earth as an element, if I speak of the earth as an element, I'm not speaking of a planet or a gross body, but as an etheric principle, a wave. This is much more, as I would read, they meant this is what we today would call spectrum. So earth means one spectrum of a wave. Yeah? And only then this tense, Timaeus later still says it so beautifully. Yeah, he has this the sieve, which the sieve, I think, not English, sieve, as a sieve. Yeah. So Plato has this thing that, like somebody, you know, who is searching for gold. You have earth and you have heavy earth. And you put water on it and so on. You want to clean it because you find out the gold, yeah, that is in the earth. And so this is exactly how Plato and Timaeus thought that the elements did separate. Because he says, Cora, space is like a sieve. Yeah? And like the sieve, you are, the space is shaking, and when it shakes, the waves which are the most heavy, they go down. And the waves which are the lightest, they go up. And so the elements which were waves did separate. So the space is like a sieve, and then so this the most heaviest wave went down. Yeah? And from there, when this heaviest wave started to accumulate, earth and gross bodies did appear. So the earth cannot be the earth. You know, this is what I call lazy thinking. This is just all colonial thinking. You think Plato was stupid. Yeah, it's just that this cannot be. You know, this was some primitive culture which had not the capacities of thinking of today. But I said, this is quite beautiful how he said. So how did the first bodies, he calls them the first bodies, how did the first bodies separate? By being shaken, and then the Scheibe, the sheet, the wave that was the heaviest went down, and out of that wave the planets did occur. Yeah? So through a culmination of that wave in a certain way, gross bodies like the first gross bodies which were created were like in the Cosmogenesis according to Timaeus. I'm speaking now about Greek philosophy. Ancient philosophy are then Uranus, which is Uranus and Gaia, which in a certain way are the first gross bodies. But they are not the principles of first. You know, that's really that we are not able to think in their way of principles. The principle of earth is not the earth as a body, but the earth as a body is a combination of the earth's principle. So the principle of earth was earlier than the body of the planet earth. Yeah? And the body of the planet earth is one becoming massive of this wave. Of they would call this wave an etheric body. This means it's part of the ether. So the ether culminates there into gross bodies. And there. This is my interpretation of Timaeus. Yeah? And I think this comes very close to also like the ancient Indian systems where this. We're thinking of this. So one thing is clear that we don't have here the lower ocean. Yeah, like we had it in the Veda. We don't have the upper ocean, but we now, as I count at the end of the Veda, the Vedanta, it becomes more anthropologic than it has been in the Veda. So over this 1,000 year, people obviously become more interested of how do I find this heart in my body in a certain way than in the cosmic body. It's not so much anymore cosmogenesis, but it becomes much more anthropological. How do we find these cosmic creatures in ourselves? Yeah? So that is for me as a kind of tendency from the earliest Veda to the end of the Veda, the Upanishad, where we are. That more and more this picture which we today know from yoga studios or so, they now more and more come, you do not find that clearly in the beginning of the Veda. Well, for me, this is much more cosmological. Yeah? And now it becomes more anthropological. It's more centered of how do these principles work in our human bodies. Yeah? As a principle, so it becomes more yoga in the sense as a technique also. Yeah? So how do we bring all these things through our bodies? Yeah? And as you said, rightly, here in the Bindu is so important because it's the end, it's the top end of the heart. I would say, yeah. It's the top end of the heart in which duality principle are centering, they are coming together. And what is beyond this Bindu is now the experience of Advaita, which is in a certain way a non-duality experience. So if you go to the top of the head, the Purusha, and this is Samkhya Yoga tradition, this picture. So this is 4th century. Yeah? And the picture is from my yoga teacher. It's from Desikachar. So the picture, by the way, is probably, I don't know exactly, I think it must be something like 1989 or something, the book came out with this picture. But in a certain way, this is typical what arises in some. So he himself stands in the Samkhya Yoga tradition, which started, also potentially wrote his Yoga Sutra in the 4th century. Yeah? So we can say this is as they in 20th century imagined to be in the tradition of 4,500 of thinking in the Indian tradition. And as I said, this is something difficult, so I could still find in the 80s a master who was in the tradition of 1,500 year yoga teachers. So they literally had that tradition survived and captured. This you cannot find in other cultures. This is, as I said, this ancient recording system which they had is really something which makes Indian studies so interesting, because it's not a past tradition, but this past tradition is still alive after 4,000 years. So So you still can find people who are living with these things today, and not quite a lot. So this is a still living thing. But I always say, who is still doing Dionysus today? Probably you, I'm sure you will find some small groups who are trying to reanimate Dionysus in a certain way in the sea entropy. We see some groups who are really worshipping still today Dionysus. But these are traditions which are lived by millions of people today. So, and not just in European or Western yoga centers. But this is a tradition that still goes on. Today. Yeah, so these are the, and of course it then says not, so this is, these are the three most important, so the Rig Veda would have called Ida, Pingala and Sushumna, what would be the technical name of the beginning of the yoga, they would have called it, what is going vertical, they always call it, it's the uprise of the river. So they would say, Sushumna, that's the central river. Yeah? That flows through yourself. This would be typical beginning of the Veda. Now you have a less poetical, usually it's a more philosophical and no more so poetical way of language. And now the rivers are no more so poetical that there is a golden river or a honey flowing. Streaming through myself. This poetic language changed and it becomes more scientific in our modern sense. It's now a channel and an art. It's an art, it's a channel. And of course it says so the three channels for the yogic understanding of the subtle body, the three are, these are the most important, Sushumna, Ida, Pingala, they are Advaita and Dvaita, duality, non-duality channel. And of course then it says there are 1,000 rhizomatic channels that like nerves go through Nervenbahn channel, yeah, as we today say. So it's the Nervenbahn. So we also use the word Bahn. Yeah? There is Blutbahn or Nervenbahn. Yeah. So that is exactly what Nadi now is. So there are the three big rivers, Ida, Pingala, Sushumna, and there are 1,000 rivers, channels who are going through rhizomatic and through our whole body. Yeah, the nerve system and the blood system, which would for the Rig Veda be rivers, flows, and it's later then Bahn channels. Yeah. The path that they go is that channel which goes upward from the heart. Yeah? Now we have many possibilities to understand this. My best reading would be that they mean here it goes up from the anu point. Yeah? So it goes up from the very top. Because the heart, they mean always the center. And the center would be the whole Sushumna. But you can also read it that in the Western sense, it goes up from the heart channel, as we would say, so from the middle of the duality principle. And of course, you can even read it, the top of the heart channel is the bindu, and from there it goes up to the top of the head in the non-duality principle. I think you cannot really distinguish clearly because all three are possible in different contexts of different passages, all three are. So in some passages, they say when you are in the heart, when you are in the Sushumna, this is the highest, the Gnostic, how we would say, heart. So you're really in the middle of your whole self. Yeah? Then sometimes they say, you are in the middle of your duality heart. Yeah, that means you are in the middle of the bindu and the anu, which is the heart center. Or sometimes they even say You are now in the heart when you have overcome the dualities. And you are in a certain way on the top of your head. And now there come the tantrics, and exactly they would say, beyond Purusha there are 11 other principles, so there is a top above you. So that's the differentiation between 4th century Samkhya Yoga and tantric philosophies, which are about 500 years later, where they say, yes, everything is right, what is here on this picture, but there is one more chakra, and that is when you can see yourself from above yourself. So where you, and they would then strongly say this happens when you die. So in a certain way, most people don't, as a people usually don't have at all this ummana, this over the head mantra, this over the head chakra. But they, in their ancient philosophy, they would say when you die, then you should be open. Yeah? And this is why so many people have the experience when they are close to death, that they have seen themselves from above themselves. Yeah? This would be because the tantric ummana, the overhead chakra for them would open. And in that way, you suddenly have an experience which most people do not have in their life, because they cannot see them from above. Yeah? But that would for them be quite natural in what is going on when you die. And because of course they have a very sophisticated philosophy of death. So all these cultures, this is really similar to what we have today, that we have mostly no philosophy of death, because we have obviously no experience of this. But you do not find this only in India. You find this in most indigenous, similar theories popping up in most indigenous culture. So obviously they had the impression that you can experience death in life. And even in India it's very strong. This experience that this is called Jivanmukti, a very strong figure, which pops up in almost all traditions. This is somebody who died before he died, which was a quote from Meister, as you probably know. So they died before they died. This means not that they became lazy, but they became more swift, yeah? Because they experienced the experience of death in their life. And this is why they could tell you something of what happens for ordinary people when they die, because they cannot experience this while they are alive. But for them, this is very natural. And this is not really not just Indian philosophy. I would say most cultures on this planet so far were convinced that you can experience death before you are literally dead. I think that is something very, that we are in a certain way the strange cultures, things that we have no experience. This is why I think why we have such a fear of death. Because really one has no experience of what will happen afterwards. Mm-hmm. So this is really the end, this is the ultimate end, which can not transcend. But again, I just from an intercultural perspective have to say that's simply not true. Because if you go into ethnology, you will see you don't have to go to philosophy. If you become an ethnologist, you will see that in almost all countries, they had that experience that some people can say and have a knowledge of what will happen for you in death. Of course, we reject and would say that's metaphysics in the worst case. But from an intercultural perspective, it becomes questionable. So that has to do a lot with them. And I told you already, this is why you're having so many all these things. I think you cannot understand them. So why do kings have crowns? By the way, this is called corona. Yeah? This is the crown chakra. Yeah? So this is really corona. Yeah? So this is the crown. So why do kings have crowns or symbols? Why do people in monasteries have, in many Christian monasteries, they have mohairs, glatze. Yeah? In India, you have the small shrines. Yeah? So I don't know of what is this in English.
Tail.
Yeah, if it's right, thank you. So you have a small tail here, or you have no hairs here. You cut your hairs here. Even in many subcultures, we will find a lot of people in subcultures doing this kind of thing, having the same fetish with what is going, cutting the hair here, you're making a tail, or all these kind of things. Yeah? So that is very typical. It's usually the crown chakra. And it is the thing where you have overcome duality, and then there is the Ummana chakra, which is 12 finger beyond. It's the mystical chakra of the 12 finger beyond, which you find very often description. So the 12 finger beyond, the 12 finger space. Also, because they had the theory, which of course is not really physically possible, but they say each chakra is 12 finger beyond the other. Yeah. And the highest is 12 finger beyond your head. That's in mana in the tantric trench. And if you would have opened that thing, you could do. So this is why example Husserl also does not work in the culture. It simply doesn't. Sorry, I admire him a lot, but he simply does not work. Because he would say that's impossible that you see yourself on your head. Yeah? Because he takes the perspectivism of European Renaissance to be something that cannot be questioned. So the European perspectivism developed in Renaissance times is the last thing you can say. You cannot go beyond your perspectivism of that your body is the zero point of your perspective in certain ways. Yeah? But from an intercultural standpoint, it's questionable, because all these cultures think that there is an escape of this kind of being, and think of Plato again, being captured in the cave of your body. You know? So these things suddenly start to become very physical experiences. If you have, but Plato is such a, he's really, and I share this, so he's very against the body and all these things. But if you see it suddenly from this intercultural perspective, it suddenly looks different, because they would say, a tantric would say, you are captured in your body, means that you don't believe there is an outside and no path outside of your body, and you cannot go outside of your body. So this is the last stage, which is the limit of your existence. But it looks differently simply from their way of looking at things.
How would you evaluate that a lot of this theory is also with this near-death experience where they saw them from above and everything have been somehow, at least that's what's been said, disproven by modern science, where they made experiments and tested things, and how would you evaluate this?
Yeah, of course, this is always, I would not like to decide here who is right and wrong. I just want to understand what they meant. Yeah? Whether we can find science, for example, they have a trick. You can call it a trick. From if you are a science person, you can call it a trick. Because they explicitly say this is Schumner has no spatial expansion. So how will you find it with a microscope? You cannot find it with a microscope. This has no spatial expansion. How would you like you can go smaller and smaller, but in their theory we'll never find this ray because it has no spatial expansion. So, but in a certain way, from this rank, all other dimensions to emerge, but it itself has no spatial dimension. So if I take that claim seriously, no natural science can ever find a proof that this does not exist, because with a with any tests which is empirical, you will not find their threat. And they will say, I told you that you will not find it. You will never find it because it has no spatial dimension. That's what they say. So that is the thing. So if we say we can prove or we can falsify this theory by experiments, then in a certain way you can never really counter them. But we have this. Think about, and take here string theory. Yeah? I was in the habilitation committee of somebody who became now quite in physics, who became quite important and strongly discussed because he became professor in Munich, you know, one of the best so-called highest-ranked university. And I know that in his habilitation theory, he was saying that string theory, in a certain way, can, per principle, never be an empirical justified theory. And therefore, many say string theory is no scientific theory anymore in the Western sense of what, because it cannot be falsified. It cannot be falsified because, in principle, there cannot be such huge dimension mathematically of objects which you would need in order to prove string theory. So string theory is a sheer metaphysical theory, and it has surprisingly the same name, thread string. Yeah? String theory is a theory which is broadly accepted by many of the leading scholars in physics, but it, in the theory, has the claim that it will never ever be proved, because we would need impossible, mathematical impossible objects in order to make the experiment whether string theory does exist or not. And here we have a similar case as we have at, if we go at the very end of matter, yeah, of scientifically. So what does it mean that modern science has proved something? Does a proof, an empirical proof, means that what you want to prove is something that can exist empirically and can be falsified? And both European string theory as this is something that they say, this is a space with a null dimension of expansion in space. This is a threat that has not a dimension, but the other dimensions are emerging out of this threat. So other dimensions you can prove, but you will never ever in eternity prove that string. Okay? With empirical experiment.
But maybe you could say that you cannot prove this kind of theories, but that you could prove that if someone claims that he has seen himself from above, and then you experimentally somehow you can validate this claim that it was either it was really that he has seen himself, or it was just explainable by some other effects and some other, and that a lot of these somehow claims were then you could question the theory which is behind it.
Yeah, of course you can say, but then you're still in the phenomenological problem of which experience counts more. So you have two experiences, and you have a scientific experience that says this was not true, and still you have the experience of those experiences which for them was self-evident. So you still have the philosophical problem of exactly what Husserl says, Erfahrung in Urteil. So I can tell somebody who is depressive that, oh, you are depressive because you have certain chemical substances are missing in. But this does not at all take away the experience of this person of having been depressed. Yeah? So that is something very different. This is why even Descartes says, if something is self-evident, you cannot bring this away. Yeah? This is something evident, this is an experience. And an experience is something which you and your consciousness have in a state of self-evidence. That is something which I have, and in that way that I have it, it is unquestionable for me. Yeah? If I have pain, I can probably find causes, empirical causes, which help me to come away from this pain. But it can, these causes, these medicines which take the pain, are not the same level as the experience of pain. These are simply two different things. Even if the medicament is doing away the pain, I still have a memory of how it felt to have that space. So in the experience, it was in a way of self-evident way there. Yeah? And I can try to change that experience in a certain way. But I cannot really undo the experience which I have. Yeah? I can say, okay, I know the causes, the empirical causes which brought you to this experience. This is the same with drugs, psychedelic drugs. Yeah? Of course, there I take a substance, a material substance, but it's not the substance, but it's the triggering of the self-evident experience that I, in a certain way, have then under drug circumstances. Yeah? And so these are two different things, yeah? Of whether I know the empirical causes of a state of consciousness, or if I speak of the self-evident truth of that consciousness. If you are on a drug trip, this is a self-evident experience for those who are on this trip. Yeah? Okay, shortly, we have to, so it's time is over already.